This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute, a nonprofit interdisciplinary research organization dedicated to providing a plan for saving civilization and a roadmap of how to get from here to there. Lester Brown was founder and president of the World Watch Institute during its first 26 years, is a MacArthur Fellow, has authored and co-authored many books, and has received a number of prizes and awards, including the 1989 United Nations Environment Prize and Japan's 1994 Blue Planet Prize for his exceptional contributions to solving global environmental problems. Lester Brown is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton Company. Welcome, Lester. What led you to write your book, Plan B 4.0?
Well, the Plan B series started 6 years ago. This is the fourth in the series. And what we wanted to do was to give a sense of what an environmentally sustainable future would look like and sort of how to get from here to there. And we did that first with Plan B, and then we realized that things were changing. We were getting a clearer sense of some of the problems. There were new environmental trends, particularly related to climate change, unfolding very fast, and exciting new responses in terms of developing renewable energy and so forth. And so we realized we're going to have to update it periodically, so we've been updating it roughly every 2 years since then.
The first chapter in your book is titled Selling Our Future. In what ways are we selling our future?
Well, most of us know about fiscal deficits. We read about them in the papers all the time. We know we're running up a record fiscal deficit in this country now in our effort to get the economy going again. But we're also running up some huge ecological deficits. And these are less well known, but no less real. One of the most dramatic is the water deficit that we're running up. We have now extensive overpumping in major food-producing countries like China, India, to a lesser degree, the United States. The World Bank points out that 15% of India's population today, which is about 175 million people, are being fed with grain produced by overpumping, which means this is not a sustainable source of grain. We have done our own estimates for China, and it looks like about 130 million Chinese are also being fed with grain produced from overpumping. And overpumping is by definition a short-term phenomenon, not something that can go on forever. And so we're concerned about how the depletion of aquifers, you know, when the wells go dry, how it's going to affect food supplies in countries like China and India, and therefore how it will affect the world food balance.
What do you see as the overriding threat to human civilization?
Probably, if you'd asked me that question 15 years ago, I would have said population growth. And population continues to be a major threat in many countries in the world, and it's undermining progress and creating political instability. But today, I'd have to put climate change at the top. And we see so many manifestations of climate change, the various ways it's affecting our economic future. Earlier this week, we released a short piece I had done entitled The Copenhagen Conference on Food Security. And the purpose of the conference was to point out that, you know, there are 193 delegations coming. They all have climate concerns of one sort or another. But the one thing that ties everything together is the effect of climate change on food security. And we look particularly at just one thing, ice melting. And what we see is that the Greenland ice sheet, for example, is melting. This is not something that could happen in the future. It is happening now. It is melting, and it is melting at an accelerating rate. If the Greenland ice sheet melts entirely, sea level goes up 23 feet. I mean, we can't even imagine a world without a Greenland ice sheet and that sort of sea level rise. But the principal effect in terms of food security of the melting of the Greenland ice sheet is on the rice crop in Asia, because much of Asia's rice is grown in rice-growing river deltas. A World Bank map shows that a 3-foot rise in sea level would cover half the rice land in Bangladesh, a country of 160 million people. A 3-foot rise in sea level, and incidentally, the projections now for this century are that sea level could go up by 6 feet during this century. A 3-foot rise would cover a large part of the Mekong Delta, for example, where half of the rice in Vietnam is produced, and Vietnam is a leading world rice exporter, second after Thailand. There are another 18 or 20 rice-growing river deltas in Asia where rising sea level will quickly shrink the harvest. And I mention this because it is not intuitively obvious when you think of the melting ice sheet in Greenland or the West Antarctic ice sheet, that this is going to affect the rice harvest, the rice supply, the price of rice in Asia and indeed in the world. Another example of ice melting is that mountain glaciers are melting everywhere in the world. The World Glacier Monitoring Center in Switzerland has just reported the 18th consecutive year of shrinking mountain glaciers. They monitor glaciers in the Andes, the Rocky Mountains, the Alps, the Himalayas, the Tibetan Plateau. The glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau are particularly important because it is the ice melt from those glaciers that sustains the major rivers of Asia during the dry season, the Indus, the Ganges, the Yangtze, the Yellow, for example. And so not only does the ice melt sustain those rivers, but it sustains the irrigation systems dependent on those rivers. And China and India both depend heavily on irrigated rice and wheat production. China's the world's leading wheat producer. India's number two. The U.S. is number three. With rice, China and India totally dominate. So anything that affects the flow of those rivers and the irrigation systems on which these countries depend have worldwide consequences. It's tempting as an American to say, well, you know, those glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau, that's China's problem. They're China's problem. That's true. But they're also our problem, because if China comes into the world market for massive quantities of grain, as it almost certainly will, and indeed has done for soybeans over the last decade. This year, China will import 70% of all the soybeans it consumes. If China comes into the world market, it will come to the United States, because we're far and away the world's largest grain exporter. For American consumers, this is a nightmare scenario, because what we're faced with is competing with 1.3 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes for our grain harvest. This will almost certainly drive up our food prices. Now, historically in this situation, we would have restricted exports, as we did in the 1970s. But China is our banker. Every month, the Treasury Department auctions off Treasury securities to cover our fiscal deficit. And one of the biggest buyers each month, and indeed some months the biggest buyer, is China. China now holds $1 trillion of U.S. Treasury bonds and notes. It's extraordinary. What it means is that, like it or not, we are going to share our grain harvest with the Chinese because China has become our banker. And the world is changing so fast, I don't think most people are realizing what's happening. But the idea that melting glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau could affect food prices at the supermarket checkout counter in this country is not something that's intuitively obvious.
Would you comment also about the land acquisition agreements that are now taking place, the purchase of farmland across international borders? It's part of what you've just been talking about.
Yes. We're witnessing a new politics of food scarcity in the world. And it began just a few years ago when in the U.S. after Katrina, gasoline prices went up $3 a gallon, and we had an explosion in investment in ethanol distilleries. And a large share of the U.S. grain harvest suddenly was going to distilleries to produce fuel for cars and therefore was no longer available for export. And then we had the dramatic rise in grain prices in 2007 and first half of 2008 when wheat, rice, corn, and soybean prices tripled. I mean, the biggest increase in history. And then exporting countries, the U.S. is already restricting its exports by diverting part of its grain harvest to produce fuel for cars. And then other exporting countries like Russia and Argentina, both wheat exporters, either restricted or banned exports in order to try to get the domestic food price rises under control because it was becoming a political problem for the governments. Vietnam banned rice exports for several months because of runaway food prices at home. And what this did was it destroyed the confidence of importing countries in the market because they can no longer assume that if they wanted to buy grain, they could, because it just wasn't there in some cases, which is why prices went up so high. I mean, it created a near panic in a lot of countries. So the more affluent importing countries are now trying to, I mean, at first they tried to do long-term bilateral grain trade agreements, the Philippines coming to Vietnam or the Yemenis going to Australia or what have you, but there weren't many of these available in the seller's market. Exporters didn't want to enter long-term agreements. So then the more affluent importing countries like Saudi Arabia, China, South Korea, just to cite three of the more active countries, began looking for land in other countries that they could lease on a long term or that they could buy. And so suddenly we have these countries acquiring massive chunks of land in countries like the Sudan, in Ethiopia, other countries in Africa, in Indonesia. And what's happening is that a lot of these investments are being made in countries that can't feed themselves today. I remember several months ago, there was a report in The Economist about a celebration held in Saudi Arabia in the King's Palace, celebrating the first shipment of rice from Ethiopia, from the land they'd acquired in Ethiopia, I mean, of all countries. And these acquisitions are huge. China's acquiring chunks of land in African countries the size of Belgium. I mean, these are not minor operations. South Korea has acquired land in the Sudan to grow wheat that is almost as large as the area used in South Korea itself to grow rice. And so suddenly we have this situation unfolding, and it raises some troubling questions. One, the land's being acquired in countries that can't even feed themselves with their land, and they're losing land and the water that goes with the land, by the way, whether it's natural rainfall or irrigation water. The Saudis bought some land in Pakistan, and then they began to wonder if they'd actually be able to get the grain out on the land they'd produced. And the Pakistani government assured them as part of the deal that they would provide up to 100,000 troops to guard the Saudi investment in land and to make sure they could get the food out. And I asked myself, guard from who? The farmers who were displaced so they could sell the land to the Saudis? Or hungry people in Pakistan because there's no longer enough food? So this has become a complex and troubling new chapter in sort of the unfolding politics of world food scarcity.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute, and author of the book, Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the key elements of Plan B 4.0 to save civilization? Would you give an overview?
Plan B is an alternative to Plan A, which is business as usual. If we stay with business as usual, we're in trouble. I mean, if we can't reverse the trends that are undermining our future, whether it's soil erosion or aquifer depletion or collapsing fisheries or deforestation or melting ice sheets or melting mountain glaciers or rising temperatures and crop withering, heat waves, if we can't get these trends turned around, we're in trouble. So Plan B is designed to address these issues. It has four principal components. One, stabilize climate. Two, stabilize population. Three, eradicate poverty. And four, restore the economy's natural support systems, soils and aquifers and forests and fisheries and so forth. It's ambitious, but it's the only option we have, because if we continue to destroy the economy's natural support systems, then eventually the economy itself will begin to decline and will collapse. I mean, this is what happened with the Sumerians and the Mayans. With the Sumerians, it was a salt buildup in the soil. It was a result of a defect in an otherwise exceptionally well-designed irrigation system. And with the Mayans, it was deforestation and soil erosion, quite possibly exacerbated by a period of prolonged drought that led to the collapse of that civilization. And food could be the weak link for us, too, though I'd resisted the idea that food could be the weak link. And we're now seeing so many trends that have been underway now for decades, like soil erosion and aquifer depletion and so forth. And you look at the list of environmental trends that we monitor, including the climate ones, and we've not turned around a single one of these trends. And you do not have to be an ecologist to understand if these trends continue indefinitely, the economy will begin to break down and we'll be facing decline and collapse, just as the Sumerians and the Mayans and the Easter Islanders did, for example. So Plan B is a response to this situation. We look at climate change, and while political leaders talk about cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which is a very convenient date for anyone holding office today, and they look at what they think is politically acceptable or politically popular, we don't start with the politics. We start with the science, and we ask the question, how much and how fast do we have to cut carbon emissions if we want to save the Greenland ice sheet, for example, or if we want to save at least the larger glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau? And when you ask those questions, it's clear we've got to move fast, cutting carbon emissions 80%, not by 2050, but by 2020. And it's an enormous undertaking, but we now have the technologies and some examples of how this can be done. We see it with energy efficiency. I mean, most of us know that if you replace an incandescent light bulb with a compact fluorescent, you can reduce electricity use 75%. But we can now go further than that. If we replace an incandescent with an LED, a light-emitting diode, and combine that with smart sensors so lights go off when no one is in a room, for example, or an office, then we can cut electricity use 90% for lighting. And this is worldwide. If we do that, then we can close 705 of the world's 2,400 coal-fired power plants. And things are beginning to move in this area. I was in California just a few days ago, and the mayor, is it Villagrosa of Los Angeles, has adopted a plan to replace the 130,000 streetlights, conventional streetlights in Los Angeles, with LEDs. And it'll take them 8 years to cover the increased cost of the LEDs over conventional lights. And after that, they will be saving $11 million a year on Los Angeles' electricity bill as a result of the efficiency of these bulbs. There's also a huge savings in maintenance because these bulbs last such a long time. I mean, the advertisements for LEDs, one of these lights, when your child is born, it'll still be working when the youngster goes off to college. I mean, they last almost a generation. So we have all sorts of things now we can do, and I cite this as just one that's already beginning to take shape. And then we're seeing extraordinary developments with renewable energy. When we were doing Plan B 3.0 and finishing it 2 years ago, we could not have imagined then the rate and the scale at which renewable energy has been developing since then. I mean, we see it with wind power in Texas, we see it with wind generation in China, and we see it in Europe with an extraordinary, huge plan to integrate the solar thermal resources of North Africa into a Europe-wide grid, a grid that actually will include North Africa and Europe. The Algerians, who are already starting to build these solar thermal power plants to export electricity to Germany via undersea cable, the Algerians point out that they have enough harnessable solar energy in their desert, which is most of the country, to power the world economy. It sounds like that must be an error, but it's not. It's an indication of how much energy there is, how much solar energy there is in desert regions of the world.
In Plan B 4.0, what will our energy portfolio look like in 2020?
Well, today, worldwide, we get about 40% of our electricity from coal. In 2020, we will be getting 40% of our electricity from wind farms in the Plan B energy plan. Solar energy, both solar thermal power plants and solar cells on rooftops, millions, hundreds of millions of buildings around the world, homes and shopping centers and office buildings and so forth. And then geothermal energy is going to play a major role. There are new technologies now that evolved in the oil industry to use geothermal heat to get the remaining oil out of old oil fields, for example. And that technology is ideal for using geothermal heat to generate electricity. So there's just enormous potentials here. And some unexpected ones. China, for example, which is a late comer to wind energy, has in each of the last 5 years, this being the fifth year, doubled its wind generating capacity. That's extraordinary. But on top of that, a government agency is now coordinating the development of 6 wind mega complexes, the smallest of which is 10,000 megawatts, the largest is 30,000 megawatts. Altogether, these 6 complexes, and this is on top of everything else they're already doing with wind, will have more than 100,000 megawatts of generating capacity. I mean, think 100 coal-fired power plants. This is huge. And recently, a U.S.-Chinese joint research team did a wind inventory for China. It was headed by Michael McElroy at Harvard. And they published an article in Science pointing out that the Chinese have enough harnessable wind energy to increase their current electricity consumption 7-fold. Again, there's an extraordinary abundance of renewable energy, whether it's wind or solar or geothermal in the world. Just a matter of developing it and getting the energy from the source to consumers.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute and author of the book Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you comment briefly on the issue of failed or failing states and their threat to global security and the ability to carry out Plan B?
If I were to identify a single political indicator that I think is going to tell us more about our future than any other, it would be the growing number of failing states in the world. Each year, the number of failing states gets longer, and it's countries like Somalia, Afghanistan, the Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, and many others. And what's happening is that pressures on governments are building, and they're associated with water shortages, with the rising price of oil, with food shortages, with a decline of natural support systems within countries. And the weaker governments are beginning to break down under these stresses. They can no longer provide personal security for their people, or governments can't provide food security anymore. And so what we're seeing is weaker governments beginning to break down, and this is how you would expect it to happen. It would be the weaker links in the chain that would go first, and then progressively the stronger ones. But the risk is, as this list of failing states gets longer year by year, it raises a question, which is how many failing states before our global civilization begins to unravel? And we don't know. We can't answer that question because we've not been here before. But we are beginning to see how some totally failed states, like Somalia, for example, can create all sorts of chaos in world shipping routes, for example. I mean, there are now 20 navies with ships in the Indian Ocean and around the Persian Gulf area to protect ships from Somali pirates. They just have little, you know, motor skiffs with rocket-propelled grenades, but they're creating havoc. They've created a new industry, you know, of capturing ships and their crews and passengers and holding them for ransom.
What are the most important steps to take to save civilization and implement Plan B 4.0?
People often ask me, you know, what can I do? And they expect me probably to say, change your light bulbs and recycle your newspapers and so forth. And those things are important. But we've got to go beyond that now. What's at stake now is the future of civilization itself. And saving civilization is not a spectator sport. We all have to get involved. Many of us, most of us have children. Many of us have grandchildren. And it's really their future we're talking about. We're not talking about something that could happen a few centuries from now. We're talking about things happening now and that are going to directly affect the world in which they will live, whether it's climate change or the stresses associated with population growth or soaring world food prices or what have you. We've got to get these trends turned around, and we don't have a lot of time to do it. Looking at the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, at some point that melting will become irreversible, but we don't know where that someplace is. Nature determines these thresholds. Nature is the timekeeper here, but we can't see the clock. That's one of our challenges. It's the uncertainty of exactly how much time we have left to get the trends turned around.
How much will it cost to reverse the trends? What is the budget for Plan B 4.0?
You know, the better question is how much will it cost if we don't reverse the trends? And the cost is probably the decline of civilization. And how do you put a price tag on that? But in Plan B 4.0, we, in looking at the need to restructure the world energy economy, go from shift from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy. We think the key to that is restructuring the tax system, lowering income taxes and raising the tax on carbon, and phasing in this shift over, say, the next decade or so, and do it so people will know what the carbon price will be each year into the future. The cap and trade system that Congress is trying to get through now leaves a great deal of uncertainty because you don't know what the price of carbon will be 3 years or 5 or 10 years from now. So it becomes much more difficult to plan. And more businesses are now beginning to back away from cap and trade because they sense the uncertainty and they don't like uncertainty in the future. And then beyond that, things like eradicating poverty, stabilizing population, restoring soils and forests and aquifers, these things will cost the world about an additional $200 billion a year, the international community. Now, that sounds like a lot. It is a lot, but the global military budget now is $1 trillion a year, or five times that. So we're looking at one-fifth of the military budget to fund the reversal of the trends that are undermining our future.
Well, we're out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The most important thing is to pick one of these issues that's important to you, whether it's closing coal-fired power plants or working with a group that's trying to help stabilize world population or launch an effort to restructure taxes. But the important thing is to get involved. Find some friends who share your concerns and pick one of these issues and go to work on it. Saving civilization is not a spectator sport. We've all got to get involved.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lester.
Diane, my pleasure.
We have just been speaking with Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute and author of the book Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton & Company. For more information, check on the web at www.earth-policy.org. Again, that's earth-policy.org. where you can download a free copy of Plan B 4.0. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.